Yeah, I have not. I did not.
Afterwards, you bet.
Where exactly do you live?
I'm going to call this meeting of the House Committee on Veterans Services and Emergency Preparedness to order for Thursday, March 26, 2015. We have several public hearings today, so I'm going to open the first public hearing on House Joint Memorial 14. Mr. Administrator, would you introduce us to that?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, House Joint Memorial 14 urges Congress and the Secretary of Veterans Affairs to direct the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs Portland Regional Benefit Office to release data regarding patient-centered community care program. There's no fiscal, maybe a revenue statement on this issued, and there is no subsequent referral.
Okay, thank you very much. It appears we have two people ready to speak, so please introduce yourself for the record and provide your comments.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank honorable committee members for hearing this bill. For the record, I'm Gene Wisnett, State Representative, House District 53. Mr. Chair and committee members, our veterans, with all that's happened in the press lately, are not being given the service that they've earned and deserve. I think this memorial is very important. My friend Colonel Tobiasen will talk about in more detail. I just want to know the committee to know that I fully support this. We need to be sure the VA is staying on this project. There's a lot of money been dedicated to educate our people about the opportunities they have to go local, and that's what this bill is talking about. I understand that in the audience is represented from the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs, and I think that they should stay on top of this too, be sure that the information is getting out to our veterans, our large veterans community in Oregon, and be sure that these guys are taken care of, that they don't have to go across the mountain in vans in bad weather to get treatment. They've earned it and they deserve it. So that's basically my comments. Colonel Tobiasen is going to give you more details about the different programs and the money dedicated to do this. So it's out there. And I appreciate again, Mr. Chair, your hearing the bill and hope you'll pass it.
Thank you for bringing it forward, Representative.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you, sir. I am Dick Tobiasen. I'm a retired Army, U.S. Army Lieutenant Colonel and a VA patient at Portland VA Medical Center in the Bend Clinic. I'm a service-connected disabled veteran due to an enemy hand grenade attack in Vietnam 48 years ago. I am the chairman of the Bend Heroes Foundation, a member of the American Legion, Military Officers Association of America, Military Order of the Purple Heart, Veterans of Foreign Wars, and Vietnam Veterans of America. My address is 22325 White Peaks Drive, Bend, Oregon. It is an honor to testify to you in support of House Joint Memorial 14. I will start out with a provocative statement. No rural civilian will do what rural veterans have to do with the VA, travel long distances for timely and quality care that is available where they live, as Representative Walden just stated. 8 years ago, I requested the U.S. Congress to create a rural veterans care program, now known as the VA Patient-Centered Community Care Program, PC3. The CEO of St. Charles Health System in Bend, the Central Oregon Health Council, and local governments and veterans groups supported this proposal to the Oregon delegation in Washington, D.C. That's 8 years ago. The objective of the new VA patient-centered community care, which we'll call PC3, is to use local health care providers rather than distant VA facilities to reduce waiting times, eliminate wasteful driving, and improve quality care. Later you'll hear from Dr. Bueller, who is my knee surgeon, who can talk about the services that he knows about that can be done locally as opposed to being done at VA. For an example, the Bend VA community-based outpatient clinic, which we call CBOX, treats about 6,500 patients in Central Oregon and refers a like number annually to Portland VA Medical Center. About half are transported by the DAV van with daily 330-mile, 10-hour round trips for 30-minute appointments. What a terrible waste of time. I was a volunteer driver for 5 years. There are significant costs to buy, maintain, and operate the many DAV vans across our nation. It's just not Oregon. It's everywhere. VA pays veterans for driving to distant medical facilities in their own cars. All of the services the VA provides in Portland and Vancouver are available in Central Oregon and many other rural areas. As HJM 14 states, the five-year temporary $9.8 billion PC3 program covering our nation has been in operation for about 18 months. VA awarded a five-year, $4.4 billion contract to TriWest Healthcare Alliance, covering 28 states, including Oregon. PC3 started as a specialty care program, but was expanded to cover primary care as well. During its December 9th, 2014 town hall teleconference, I requested the Portland VA regional office to tell us how much of the $4.4 billion has been allocated to Oregon, how many veterans are qualified, and how many are participating in PC3, and what's the impact on the waiting times that we're all experiencing at the big cities and the rural areas. I submitted these my questions. I was told by the VA on the teleconference that these were good questions and they deserve answers. There was no one in the VA knowledgeable about PC3. I spent 5 minutes even educating them in what PC3 was all about. The VA advised me that later that they do not report funding by state or VISN. VISN is a Veterans Integrated Service Network, and Oregon, Washington, and Oregon are in VISN 20. And later on, I'll talk about the memorial that you may want to adjust the memorial's target to the VISN as opposed to the VA regional office, because the VISN has the data that we seek. But they did tell me how many health care providers are in Central Oregon are in the PC3 program, about 1,400. And they told me that they have ways to make sure their contractor is doing its job, but their measurements are not available to the public. So that contractor, TriWest Healthcare Alliance, has $4.4 billion to account for in 28 states. To date, veterans, rural healthcare providers, and taxpayers cannot get data to measure the effectiveness of PC3. It is still a temporary program, and that should be a concern to all of us. What happens when PC3 is finished, which is about 3 years from now? If it's a good program, why would it die? The new VA Choice Card, and I want to talk about this as the newest program, and the Choice Card issues are overshadowing PC3. No one is talking about PC3, even though it's the same amount of money as Choice. But the new VA Choice Card resulted from congressional hearings in D.C. last year on the well-known widespread of VA abuses or scandals at several VA medical centers. We all know about that. Choice began last November, so there has not been much time to measure effectiveness. Choice is another temporary three-year program that would allow VA to build more facilities and hire more people to do the job. Congress allocated $10 billion to Choice on top of the $9.8 billion that we already have in PC3, and another $5 billion on top of that to hire more medical staff. The scope of the PC of the Choice program is about the same as PC3. Reduce waiting times, reduce travel distance, get your health care done where you live. Don't travel long distance. So the VA has issued 8.5 million Choice cards. I have one, although I didn't ask for one. And I live within 4 miles of a VA facility. So why did I get a card? The VA is issuing to everybody not only is eligible today, who might be eligible in the future. So that's why it's 8.5 million. The VA added Choice Card programs funds to its two contractors managing PC3. So now, TriWest Healthcare Alliance, located in Washington State, has 4.4 plus a share of the 10. There's a lot of money out there, as Representative Wisnett said. There's a lot of money out there. Now there is $20 billion out there to reduce waiting times for veterans by using local providers near their residents. Without data, there is no way to know if PC3 or Choice are working as intended. Many of us, including the Congress, are skeptics, severe skeptics about the program, about the VA's performance. I believe VA is under a lot of pressure from Congress to make Choice work, even though the VA has requested to divert some of the money out of Choice into unspecified in-house VA programs. The president's budget has that. It's going to take money out. Well, obviously, the Congress is not happy with that at all. It's a non-starter. The VA states that the veterans do not have a high interest in Choice as a reason for wanting to take that money back. Now, let's talk about that. Veterans are very skeptical and confused by the process, as evidenced by a recent study by the Iraq-Afghanistan Veterans of America, IVA, called The Weight We Carry. It's not the weight on our backs, it's the weight that we wait for the VA. Only one-third of the 1,800 veterans who responded to the survey, and they're mostly young veterans, Iraq and Afghanistan veterans, only one-third of them say that the VA health care is acceptable to them. Now, the VA has different numbers, but that's the troops. That's what they say. And they're the ones who are the most newly enrolled in VA health care programs. They're the younger ones. 28 of those 1,800 respondents are from Oregon. Their names are on their website. You can go find out who they are, where they live, and what their thoughts are. A fellow Vietnam veteran friend of mine from Bend is 100% disabled and suffers from PTSD. He was issued a choice card. Let's call him Joe. I won't use his name because I didn't ask him to do that. Joe was at the Portland VA Medical Center all day yesterday and all day today, and where he's being treated for skin cancers and neurological issues. The VA told Joe that he could not use his choice card because he lives more than 40 miles away from the Bend Clinic. But the Bend Clinic doesn't do dermatology or neurology. So the next week, that law is going to change. The Congress holding hearings next Tuesday say, let's change that so it's not 40 miles from any VA, but it's from the facility that provides the care that you need. Well, Joe lives 160 miles away from the Portland VA Medical Center, so he would next week hopefully be eligible. He wouldn't have wasted 2 days driving and all that. And the VA had to pay his driving expenses. So that's another case of the VA narrowly interpreting the law that Congress passed last year. And the Congress has said many times, you are intentionally withholding benefits from veterans because you do not use the authority we gave you in that law to interpret things like, big deal, 40 miles, as the crow flies. Well, if you use that law's changed 2 days ago, as your driving distance, which doubles the number of eligible veterans. Just a simple thing like that. Why did Choice use a 40-mile criteria and PC3 use driving time? Why are there two different categories? Why are there two different criteria? So that's going to be changed next week, and that will remove the second impediment to getting veterans. But that's not the only problem. Veterans give up calling the Choice program because they got busy signals and get put on hold. They totally had the wrong phone number. And like Joe, they were sent hundreds of miles to a VA facility when the help was right next door where they live. Today's Ben Bulletin has an exceptional article about the problems with Choice, and there are five veterans in there who are suffering because the VA cannot administer the program the way it is intended. But to be fair, the Portland VA has responded to some of my questions on the number of veterans receiving health care through Choice. I got a typo in my testimony. The 46,000 is the number in the United States. In Oregon, it's somewhere between 551 and 1,000. 2 weeks ago, it was 500. Today, it's 1,000. But there are 96,000 veterans in Oregon enrolled in the VA health care program. How many of those are issued Choice cards, and how many are participating? We do not know. If VA can report Choice statistics, which they have to the Congress, why can't they do the same thing with PC3? Well, that's the reason we're here. Why can't they report performance on the PC3 program as you envision in HJM 14? My suggestion is that since the Congress is now really interested in the VA, it would be important for our memorial to not only go to the VA and the Secretary of the VA and whatnot, it should also go to the Oregon delegation of Washington to get on Chairman Miller's and Chairman Isaacson's agenda to say this is a national program of getting performance measurement. How are you spending that money? How are veterans? What's the quality of care? The VA secretary is sending a team of inspectors out next week to VA, to the contractors, TriWest and the other contractors. Why are you having such long waits, and why are so few people signing up for Choice? There are reports that veterans will have to pay for local non-VA care. So if a veteran gets health care from a private doctor in Bend, he has to pay the bill, and it takes years sometimes for the VA to pay back. That's in here. The VA, not today. The scandal of the day is 23,000 veterans in Louisiana are going to lose their private health care, lose their access to private care called non-VA, because the VA was withholding payments to providers. 23,000. The VA and the Congress are still negotiating the 40-mile driving distance criteria and VA diversion of choice funds to undefined in-house VA programs. In fact, the Senate Veterans Affairs Committee will hold hearings on the 40-mile criteria next week, and I've asked Senator Wyden and Representative Wallen to not allow the VA to divert funds intended for veterans to go into more buildings. 2 days ago, on March 24th, the VA announced the 40-mile criteria will change from as the crow flies to actual driving distance. Reportedly, this revision will double the number of veterans eligible for the Choice Card. That is a big victory for veterans and Congress. To us veterans, the VA seems to be finding ways to degrade choice by narrow interpretations of the VA of the 40-mile driving distance criteria and building an empire rather than serving veterans where they live. PC3 and Choice are new, but temporary programs. They're temporary. They expire in 3 or 4 years. They have fine goals. They represent a new way of doing business, as we requested 8 years ago. VA has experienced problems in implementation and telling veterans, healthcare providers, and the public, and not telling us about their performance. In fact, the U.S. House of Representatives Veterans Affairs Committee, Chairman Miller's committee, recently created the VA Honesty Project. The goal of that project is simple: to highlight the Department of Veterans Affairs' lack of transparency with the press and the public about its operations and activities. On January 26th, I submitted the following statement on PC3 implementation to the House VA Honesty Project. The Portland VA Medical Center and Regional Office will not inform the public how many veterans are being treated under its new PC3 program, nor will the Portland VA disclose how much of the $4.4 billion five-year contract with TriWest Healthcare Alliance covering 28 states is allocated to its service area, i.e., Vision 20. VA did respond on how many local healthcare providers have been enrolled by PC3 by TriWest. I submitted my five questions that I asked on the telephone. I submitted those to Washington, and I've not had a reply. It is time to hold the VA accountable for the expenditure of public funds and measure effectiveness of PC3 and Choice by requiring performance measurement and periodic public reporting. In my view, there should be a third party involved to make sure the program is properly reported. The two programs should be consolidated in one. They have the same goals. If PC3 and Choice can be made to work as intended, they should become permanent. We should get the VA out of that business. They've proven time and time again that they can't do the job, and you've read some of the horrible examples of that. The VA, the president of VA, and the secretary just announced a new advisory committee last 2 weeks ago, and maybe they will be an organization to measure performance in both as we want in HGM 14. I would like to thank Representative Newt Bueller for initiating HGM 14 with support from Senator Knoop and Representative Wisnant. 10 years ago, Dr. Bueller replaced my knee that was damaged in combat in Vietnam. That surgery was eligible under Medicare. That is a blessing for us older veterans, but not available to veterans that are not qualified for VA Medicare. This kind of surgery is a must for the VA to contract out. You may have read the recent report of a veteran's horrible experience with VA leg surgery that ended up with amputation when non-VA surgeons discovered botched VA surgery. You probably read that. Drill bits left in here, broken screws. Time and time he went for surgery after surgery after surgery. Went out and got a second opinion from private doctors that the leg's coming off. He's no longer in pain. That's awful. Daily reports of VA failures are all we have for information on the VA's performance. Performance measurement and public reporting will force the VA to disclose to the public how it is meeting or not meeting its goals. Also, building more VA facilities is another waste, as proven by the huge cost overrun of the new VA hospital in Denver. The original cost was $328 million. Now it's $1.73 billion, five times what the original estimate was. How many more veterans could have been treated with that money? And the VA official in charge of that retired yesterday. VA should really expand its contracting out. Do more of this. Do more of this. Become expert at auditing the people that it awards contracts to, and make prompt payments to providers and veterans. We have veterans out there that will be in bankruptcy because the VA has not paid its bills. And there's an issue, there's an example of that in here. As the issues in HGM 14 should be of national concern, this is not just Oregon. We can only hope HGM 14 will be treated seriously by the VA and the Congress. That Honesty Project has 72 cases of where the VA refuses to give even representative and congressmen answers to simple questions. My five questions are part of that. I don't know if I'll ever have an answer. I respectfully urge the committee to expand its resolution to include the Choice Card Program on line 31 and add the Oregon delegation in Washington, D.C. to the recipients of this memorial. Perhaps they can follow up with implementation with the VA. And I think we should take the ODVA suggestion that the memorial should ask the VISN, the VISN 20 for the data as opposed to the regional office. That's where the data reside. Thank you, Chairman Lively, and committee members for providing this opportunity to testify in HGM 14. I plan to testify next Tuesday on SJM 11 because it is similar to HGM 14, but I don't know why there's a big difference between the two. But I would be pleased to try to respond to any questions the committee may have. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Tobiasen. Representative Buehler, welcome to our committee.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Lively, and thank you, members of the committee, and also thank many of you for co-sponsoring this important memorial. I don't have much to add after that powerful voice, and I'd like to thank Dick for his dogged determination on this issue. He first brought it to my attention well over a year ago, and we are finally getting some momentum to help solve this problem. And we also, I have to admit, didn't coordinate with the Ben Bullet, and that article just by good luck came out today, right when we're I didn't have anything to do with it. Maybe you had something to do with it, but and I think that also really outlines the problem in a personal way, and something that we see frequently in Central Oregon. And the problem really, to boil all this down, is twofold. The underlying problem is a lot of veterans, specifically in rural areas, have a very difficult time accessing the VA medical system for a variety of reasons. Either the long appointments, or it's just a long distance, or it's very inconvenient for them, in addition to the bureaucratic challenges that you all hear about on a frequent basis. The good news is there has been some efforts at developing these programs, such as Choice and C3, to address them. The problem is, for whatever reason, there's different opinions, the veterans aren't learning about these programs to the point that we can't even get meaningful data on what's being done in terms of access for the veterans. So these, and these are billion-dollar programs. PC3 alone is $9.8 billion already fully funded. And we think there's a limited number of people in the state of Oregon that know about it, or veterans that are accessing care through it. And it's so important. I mean, these stories in Central Oregon are heartbreaking, and I take care of some of these. I've never been in the military myself, but I've worked at a VA medical center, and for years I've taken care of their chronic battlefield injuries, like Dick here. And the stories are horrendous. And let me tell you one I heard during the campaign. A 30-year-old veteran in Central Oregon with service-connected brain cancer, multiple trips to the Portland VA Medical Center, not feeling well, undergoing chemo, has a young family. His wife has to leave work, drive him the 4 hours to Portland for a 30-minute visit, maybe to get an MRI. Either stay there or drive all the way back to Central Oregon, back again 2 days later for a 15-minute appointment with a physician to help interpret the MRI. And since he's doing this every 6 months or so, seeing the response to treatment, it gets to be an incredible drag on the family, both financially and emotionally. Well, it's PC3, if he knew about it, and he didn't even know about the program until we told him about it, he could have gotten most of those visits right in Central Oregon without that burden. And those are the types of stories we hear over and over again. Now, granted, this memorial is not going to solve this problem. And the reason we bring it even, and I know your time is valuable, the reason we bring it before you is for two reasons. One is just to draw attention to this. So we get the profile, and that's working. You know, Dick's finally getting some data from the Portland VA that he's been asking for. You're hearing it. It's in the newspaper. So hopefully more veterans will learn about these programs just from these efforts. And the second thing is to get that data, to understand how many people actually are accessing this important program. So I thank you for taking the time on this important issue, and hopefully we'll show more progress over the coming months.
Thank you very much. Any questions for these witnesses? Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Rep. Buehler, in your conversations with ODVA, is Mitch and the other trainers over there training VSOs how this works? is the word getting out? Because I got to tell you, I'm learning a lot myself here. I don't have a card, Dick. And, you know, to show, if you're not in the VA system, to show you how, probably a simple example of how this, think of Medicare, and what if there was a Medicare hospital in Portland, and that was where everybody had to go to get their care, or one Medicaid hospital in Portland. I mean, it's ridiculous to think of it in those terms, but that's what we're asked to do.
Yeah. I should respond to that, sir. ODVA has published articles about PC3 and choice in their vets newsletter, and it's online too. So I think there's a lot of exposure from ODVA on that.
Representative Escobar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am in the system, and I don't know. I didn't get a card. But what I don't like about the VA system is that if you have a certain something wrong with you, you have to either go to Roseburg, you have to go to Portland, or you have to go to White City. And, gee, what if you lived in Pendleton and you had to go to White City?
Yeah.
You know, well, that's what they
or
do.
Or what if you lived in Lakeview had to go to Portland?
Well, Lakeview goes to
Portland. I understand that, yeah. Dick. But the system itself is not only internally broken, but the system itself is broken.
Yeah.
And the federal government has got to come to grips with this because, you know, when you send people off into harm's way, when they come home, you sure better take care of them. And we're not doing that, I don't think. Yeah. That's just my 2 cents worth.
Chair Lively, Vice Chair Escobar, and Representative Huffman, you all make great, great points. And it is our sacred duty to take care of these folks who've served their country. And I think Representative Huffman's analogy is spot on. If Medicaid had one Medicaid hospital in Portland where we all had to travel, you know, 4 hours or more to get treatment, and to be fair, I do think there is a specific need for veterans facilities, and I've worked in them as a surgeon myself. There's some veterans who need a facility that understands the veterans, has a unique skill set. That always will be needed. But there's no reason why everyone has to go to these very bureaucratic, very controlled environments, just like Medicare. And the PCT program is similar in a way where it's federally financed but privately delivered close to home, and that's kind of the Medicare model. And I think they should go in that direction, especially with the increasing number of veterans needing to be served.
May I add something, Mr. Chairman? So Dr. Bueller is with the center in Bend, and he did my knee and my wife's knees, and he got his company to be the first contractor for PC3. In probably Oregon, if not Central Oregon, with TriWest. So I would like to salute you, sir, for getting, there are about 1,400 contractors, the VA says, and I don't know where they all are, but they won't give us the numbers. Yeah. They won't tell us who they are, who are PC3 contractors to TriWest using the VA money, right? You're 14, they won't tell us who they are.
Let me just add that, sir. Dick, to his credit, did the background research. We'd never even heard about it, as in we're a group of 40 medical providers, deliver a lot of healthcare services in Central Oregon. Dick found TriWest. We had to badger TriWest for weeks to even get us a contract. Yeah. So I don't know what they're doing in terms of administrating this program, but it's like they didn't even, you know, engage.
Yeah.
So we appreciate your bringing this to us, Representative Bueller. I can tell you we've had, since this committee has been meeting this session, we've had multiple conversations about both information to veterans so they even know what's out there and then the access, how you do it. It's a huge challenge, but we appreciate you bringing this forward.
Thank you. Thank you.
So thank you. Also, Dennis?
No, Dick covered everything very well. I don't think I could add anything to it. I'm just here to observe. I think one point.
Please come to the microphone and introduce yourself if you want to make a comment. Thank you. Just so we have it on the record.
My name is Dennis Guthrie. I'm from Redmond, Oregon. I was a combat medic in Vietnam. This 40-mile thing, which seems to be taken care of, this is the attitude, and I think one of the points that was made when I was back in D.C. is that If you're standing on the south edge of the Grand Canyon, you can see the other side a mile away. But to get to that same spot a mile away, you got to drive 120 miles this way, turn around, and come back another 120 miles. So that's not really as the crow flies. They're going to fix this, but this is the same type of attitudes that the VA seems to be having. And so I think this is what Dick was saying, and I don't really have anything else to add. But I think it's important that we pressure them to get this information out so that it's disseminated amongst those of us who really care.
You bet. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your time.
Sure. Anybody else who wishes to testify on House Joint Memorial 14? Not, I'll close the public hearing on House Joint Memorial 14. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Joint Resolution 22. Mr. Administrator.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, House Joint Resolution 22 proposes amending the Oregon Constitution to include providing services to veterans as among the purposes for which net proceeds from the lottery may be spent.
Okay. Give me 1 second.
Okay, 1 second.
1 second.
Let me guess whose bill this is.
Yeah.
I think I've seen the movie before. I'm not sure.
That could be. Give me
Since she asked for a second, it might be Representative Parrish.
She's fought for this for a long time.
Yeah. All right. Good afternoon, Chair Lively, members of the committee. For the record, Julie Parrish, Westland, Tualatin, House District 37, bringing you HJR 22, which was once HJR 29, when 59 legislators were sponsored on that. You'll notice only my name this time on this, because I want to continue to bring attention to this issue. HJM 29 is also IP3, and many of the people in this room that you see today who've served our country are actively out gathering signatures for the ballot initiative side of this bill. But I am going to bring up many of the points that some of you have heard before. It's too bad some of our new members aren't here to hear some of this as well. HJR 22 seeks to direct 5% of the undedicated portion of the Oregon Lottery proceeds, net proceeds, to veterans programs and services, and then put them into our Constitution in perpetuity, or at least as long as the lottery exists, for the purpose of caring for our veterans. Now, what that actually means is that we would like to be able to use those dollars, including but not limited to assistance with reintegration, employment, education benefits, tuition, housing, health care, including mental health and addiction treatments, access to state and federal benefits for veterans and spouses and dependents of veterans. We also would like to see permanent dollars available for county veteran service officers, campus veteran service officers, tribal and nonprofit veteran service officers as well. So you have heard Cameron Smith come from ODVA come and talk to us about the economic benefit side of veterans. And I want to talk and speak to this because the original purpose of the lottery when it was created in 1984 was specifically, while people believe it was for education, specifically was for economic development. The most recent number I've seen, and I still think it's a wrong number, but it's the one I can correctly be politifacted on, is that for every dollar we send to Uncle Sam, we are only getting 93 cents back. And historically, over the last 30 years, we have been a donor state to the rest of the nation. So when we look at ways to bring our dollars home, there is no faster way that we can do that than to make an investment with some state dollars into veterans programs and services. You've heard Cameron Smith share that of the, by census, somewhere between 320 and 25,000 veterans in Oregon, roughly 100,000 of them are connected with the VA. Now, that's not to say that every veteran who has served in the military has earned some benefits, but with 225,000 veterans unaccounted for as having checked in with the VA at some point or another, the odds are high and that we will actually have veterans who do have benefits, and particularly from the Vietnam era. And I think that's really important because you're talking about, from that age group and generation, a population of veterans who does not want to come in and have a conversation with the VA, which is why we have tribal and nonprofit veteran service officers as part of this petition and the subsequent resolution. We think it's important that people who are not necessarily directly affiliated with our government be a line of defense for a veteran coming in and seeking services. And some of these folks have not sought services in 40 years and probably are owed quite a fair substantial amount of dollars, and particularly given the health care issues. And we talked about that the other day with a different bill, certainly some of the Agent Orange experience. You heard even Representative Esquivel share his story. So we know that there is a large population of people who have not connected with the VA and who are and have earned those benefits. We've also heard Cameron Smith over periods of time share the Oklahoma story, where Oklahoma as a state has about the same population we do. And what they've done is they've worked to the veterans who are in the system, they've worked to actually help maximize the determination from the VA and that benefit. So let me explain how that works. So my husband left the service after 23 years and was given an initial rating from the VA. Now, the VA, we're now 37 months into a claim with the VA for his service, has yet to rate him on probably the most egregious piece of his health care that he has. And so we're still going through that process. So when we find a veteran or somebody, what Oklahoma's done is said, okay, so if you've been rated for, say, 50%, but maybe you're owed actually 70%, they've been very aggressive with helping to reach the furthest end of the determination for VA benefits. So what that has meant for Oklahoma is $400 million more a year into their economy by serving veterans than Oregon for helping serve the same population. And you've heard Cameron Smith tell us numerous times, we are only serving 3 out of 10 veterans in the state of Oregon. That means we're leaving an opportunity cost of potentially hundreds of millions of dollars on the table and 7 out of 10 veterans who are still not being served. And while I do not want to make this an economic argument, it seems that in this building, this is might be the only way we can make an argument, the actual doing this bill and passing this resolution, because it is the right thing to do for serving veterans, doesn't seem, it seemed to have fallen on deaf ears when we had 59 previous sponsors and we couldn't even get this pulled to the floor for a vote. So so I'm going to make it now an economic issue. If that's what we want to talk about, dollars and cents, and treat people like dollars and cents, then I will make that argument. Because at the end of the day, we're talking about real money moving through our economy, going out into our businesses, covering health care costs and other things that our state general fund is picking up the tab in other forms of social services. So I'm happy to make the economic argument today to you. I've asked our revenue office to actually create me a construct for what that looks like. So if we had $400 million more dollars, and that money is likely tax-free, because anybody who is a retiree is already getting a 1099 and they're seeing retirement benefits now. Somebody like my husband, who is not connected to all the way to the disability piece and the highest level of his entitlement, that money doesn't show up on your 1090 on a 1099 or on your W-2, you know, on your taxes anyway. So we can't account for that. So when you heard Cameron Smith say that our veterans who are connected somehow are about $1.1 billion, only 22,000 of that 100,000 are represented with a 1099-R, which is what you get as a retiree from the federal government, from the Department of Defense. So that means that the rest of the population of the 100,000 we're serving are really, we're talking about disability compensation. So if I'm just going to make the argument on this measure today around disability compensation is tax-free. So if we were to have $400 million more tax-free dollars coming from our federal government, which was earned by a veteran being spent in our economy, they're really simple math that when it is taxed at some point in the system and our tax rate, we're an income tax state, folks, so 9.9% income tax, this actually becomes, not only does it become potentially cost neutral if voters should choose to vote on this. And again, this is not us saying we're going to allocate 5%. This bill is simply asking voters, shall we make the decision to do the undedicated portion of lottery and put that in? So $400 million to make us comparable with Oklahoma, more dollars in our economy, will actually come back and potentially make this a cost-neutral bill. And if we start to get to the 4 and 10 and 5 and 10 veterans in the next decade, we're really talking about a revenue positive for the state of Oregon. Now, this bill, when it was in HJR 29, had a subsequent referral to revenue. This has no fiscal impact. For a comparable measure, the bill itself is a referral to the voters to ask them if they would like to choose to use the undedicated portion of lottery in this manner. Now, voters in Oregon have chosen to allocate and lock up pieces of the lottery four different times, twice for education and twice, once as a initial dedication and then as a subsequent permanent dedication for parks and fish. So near as I can tell, we have about 51% of the lottery is constitutionally dedicated. HJR 22 does not touch the constitutional dedication of lottery. What it does is it looks at the 49% that we have the discretion to spend. Now, our legislative council has told me that while the ballot title we were given for the IP3 version of this language speaks to the potential to reduce dollars for economic development and education, folks, constitutionally and statutorily, we have no obligation to actually spend the money on either. So we could say all the money is going to go to economic development, all the money could go to education. We have no, our hands are not bound in that other 49%. And I say that because this body, as a choice, a spending choice in 2013, tucked into some of the community college bonding bills $10 million for a convention center hotel with lottery dollars. Now, that's $1 million, roughly $1 million more than we dedicated out of general fund to the entire ODBA budget for an entire biennium. So we make spending decisions with lottery in this building every session we come here. This bill empowers the voters to make a spending decision with those dollars, and it has a positive economic interest and impact. So when I say that this bill has no fiscal impact, I'm comparing this to, I believe it was Measure 87, 86 or 87. I don't remember the exact measure, but it was the bill that we put forward and we voted out of off the floor about whether we would use give the legislature authority to use our bonding dollars for higher education. So a referral from this body and the fiscal impact that was put on that referral, which would have had potentially in a subsequent legislative session a fiscal impact, only had a fiscal impact of about $500 according to the measure summary statement that we brought up on that measure. So really the only fiscal impact with this bill in this session is the cost to put it on the ballot and let people vote. So let me talk about where the people of Oregon are at with this. We are currently in the IP3 side of this, the ballot initiative side, where we've asked some of our veterans and people standing in this room to go stand in front of places like DMV and at schools and at their churches to go get the signature, since we shamefully did not get this out the door. And you can tell I'm very passionate about this, but now people are out gathering signatures to do that. We've pulled on this. We've asked the voters. So not only are we have hundreds of volunteers out now gathering signatures, and thousands of people have already signed the petition that they would like to vote on this. We polled. We did some polling. We said, do you think Oregonians, do you think the state of Oregon is doing, not the feds, the state of Oregon is doing enough to help our veterans? In that survey, more than 50% of people said, nope, we don't think that we're doing enough. So more than half. The rest of them were sort of divided between, well, we don't know, big chunk, we don't know, and a very small fraction in the camp of, we think we are doing enough. When we asked, though, would you vote on 5% of lottery for veterans programs and services, depending on what part of the state we were polling into and asking that question, because we sampled around, the lowest number in my own house district was 65%. And in the highest, suburbia, Portland, not necessarily conservative district, 71%. And if we asked the next question, we said, if you thought that this would take away money from schools and economic development, would you still vote for it? And the only slippage we saw in one district was 3 points. So from 71% to 68%. Clearly, Oregonians would like to see us do this. And I think it is deplorable that this body is asking people who've already served their country once to go out and gather the signatures and to spend the money and to take money out of their own pocket, some of them who don't have the money, to go out and put this to the ballot. So without having asked any member of this committee this time to, sorry, and I'm grumpy about this bill, but without having asked anybody in this committee to support this time, I will not put 58 other legislators on the hook for our failure to get this done. I am still committed to going into every district, all of your districts in this state, and having the conversation that please sign petitions, please take a kit, please go out and ask 100 people in your community to put this to the ballot. And what this means long term, the money side aside, is that we have the ability to help somebody who truly has need. We know that the VA is backlogged. We could make the argument as a legislative body that this is the job of the federal government. But folks, a lot of these people served from Oregon. They were our troops to begin with, before they were ever federalized for anything else. They belonged to us. All of our National Guard and reserve folks who were just stationed right here out of Oregon and served us, and they fight our floods and our fires, and they show up in Merrill, Oregon when they, you know, the town loses its well and it's without water, because that happened a few years ago. I got that call at our house. They have served us, so we have an obligation to serve them. We talk a lot in this building about we're here to do the people's work. Well, I can tell you, in three tries to get it to the ballot with thousands of signatures, and we bucked that system multiple times, but we have collected already thousands of signatures and volunteers, hundreds of volunteers out right now with their little clipboard kits showing up everywhere, and clear polling that says people want to do this. Folks, the people's work is giving this to the people and letting them make the decision. So this bill has a subsequent referral to rules this time, which is the proper place where it should have gone, because there is no darn fiscal impact. Now, in the first year of passage, what would happen in 2017 and the 17-19 biennium is that $26 million a year, roughly, would be the number, would be appropriated. And the likelihood is that we understand that that would mean probably no general fund dollars, as much as I don't want to do that. It would probably mean no general fund dollars going to ODVA, and what we've sort of done with Parks and Fish, where the lottery dollars came in and supplanted that. That's fine, because it's still a lot more than the $4.5 million a year right now we give to ODVA. So we'd be okay with that. We know that it's taking 3 years to get people on average through the system, but in the situation like I've described with Mark, what's going to happen is the year he finally gets his packet put together the right way, the VA is going to write him a big check. And near as I can tell right now, it's going to be a pretty significant check. And if they move, it takes another year to get that done, it's going to be a six-figure check. That's real money that my family is going to spend in the economy. And we're going to put it out into our communities, and we're going to shop with it, and we're going to do things with it. I cannot imagine if we were in a position financially where we were waiting for that money and it was the only lifeline we had. We are fortunate and blessed to be in a position where that is not the case. But for thousands of our veterans, it is a huge problem. That waiting is a huge problem. So not only does this bill have the economic development side, if that's the argument I have to make and put a price tag on all of these people's heads behind me, I'll make that argument if that's what gets this through the building. But the reality is that the ability to properly connect people with their GI bills, their health care dollars, their disability compensation, home loans, that's real economic development for us. And we talk about that a lot. We talk about a lot in this building about jobs bills. This is a jobs bill because the money will get spent out in the community. I do not envision this body, or my esteemed colleagues who I know care about these issues, I don't see us saying that this $26 million a year we're going to outsource to other states like other agencies do. This is money that's going to get spent right at our county levels with VSOs. It might support some of the programs that, frankly, we've all brought bills in this building that have a fiscal impact, and we all as a policy decision say we care about these things, and the next thing we know is they go down to Ways and Means and they die. Passage of this means that we have some money to actually serve the people sitting behind me today. And so I'm not stopping, and I could be completely unelected if this thing ever got to the ballot and voters voted on it and I never got reelected again. You know, folks, that would be okay. I would feel like I have done my job, and one of the main reasons I came to this building was to serve this population. And so if that happened, I would happily walk away from politics and be done. this is one of my key priorities. That's why I don't have a whole bunch of other bills in front of you this time, because all of the things I want to do cost money. And our colleagues in the rest of this building don't want to write the check. So let the people of Oregon write the check for us. And with that, I will take any questions.
Questions for Representative Parrish? So, Representative Parrish, I have one question.
Yes.
I'm just probably confusing this. So I'm trying to understand the ballot initiative related to this particular House Joint Resolution.
This resolution was sent to the people. Shall we vote
5%? What you're trying to do on the ballot measure.
Yes, they are parallel paths to the same outcome, sir.
Thank you very much. Representative Boone.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Julie, for Representative Parrish, for doing this again. And your energy and your passion for it sort of reminds me of somebody else who was not a representative but tried to get a bill through earlier in the Equal Rights Amendment and ended up spending quite a bit of her own money to do it. But she did take it to the people, and they did pass it by 71%.
Yep, that's right.
And so now we just got to make sure it goes, you know, it gets upheld. And this is great. I'm glad you're doing this. I think the lottery's been, you know, a good thing overall economically for Oregon, and this is another area where we can, because things like the lottery, it's gone from one thing to adding different purposes that they can use the money for, and I think this is very valid, and if it can help us get our veterans what they need and what they deserve and earned, that I think that's good, so.
Chair Lively, Boone, I'll just say what happened with Measure 89, which was the ERA, where we had the opportunity, and again, a ballot, a piece of legislation where we had total bipartisan support to move that, and then to ask a private citizen to have to write a $350,000 check. Well, I mean, that's her own commitment, I think, was somewhere in that $350,000, $400,000 range. To take that when we could have done the work is not how our representative government is supposed to work. And we had the same situation with HJR 29 in that same year. And while I wish I could personally write a $350,000 check to go do the work, that's not the case. I'm not in a position to do that. Otherwise, I probably would, because it really means that much to me. So while I don't have $350,000 to get it to the ballot myself, I do have a lot of time. And that's time to show up into every corner of the state and drive into all of your districts and show up at all your Rotary clubs and your chambers of commerce and talk about why the legislature didn't get this done again. And the people behind me certainly can share their stories, and I'm going to give up the microphone so they can do that. But I will just add that this concept, either as a bill or a ballot initiative, is endorsed by the Veterans of Foreign Wars, the American Legion, the United Veterans Groups of Oregon. I think you'll also see at some point the United Veteran Groups of Oregon is all of our sort of federally recognized veterans groups, so DAV, Purple Heart, Vietnam veteran organizations, they're all in there, but individually we'll be seeking an endorsement from every single one of their boards. Again, these folks represent thousands of your constituents, and they are here telling you, pass this bill and do this. But we'll go get the signatures if we have to. So thank you.
Thank you for bringing us forward, Representative Parrish. Okay, I'll now call on Ken Kraft, Jason Carroll, and Judith Berger. Please introduce yourself for the record before you speak.
Ken Kraft, Morgan City, Oregon. The Department Judge Advocate for the Veterans of Foreign Wars of Oregon. It's an honor to be here, Mr. Chairman and members, and I applaud your leadership, Representative Parrish. I'd like to tell you, the last several years, we have done the petitions for the signatures on this, and the Veterans of Foreign Wars has strongly supported this issue. When I was in Baghdad, Iraq, I was hit by a mortar attack and lost both my knees. And a hard landing after that, my back was crushed. I came home to 23 to 30 surgeries. As an officer, I can tell you, going through the system, even with a service officer, was not easy. Next week, April 7th, I have one of my knees removed again. It's 25th surgery. I'll be in a wheelchair for 6 months. I'm over 100% permanent total. Last March, and I have the little letter that VA sends you out. Last March, I got a letter from the VA saying, go to Hillsborough and see this doctor you've never seen. He's never seen you. Get in his office, and the first thing I ask him is, you know, why am I here? There's a lot of young men and women who have never been or waiting for their first initial CMP so they can get in the system. He says, well, we're going to review it. I said, why would you review 100% permanent total? Well, they did. They wanted to reduce it. So evidently, replaced knees get better. I don't know. So about a month later, I was down at Spirit Mountain, and the new director for the VA Medical Center, which came up out of California, was there, and the regional director. And I talked to both of them and explained this. They said there's absolutely no way this should happen. Well, I was already working with some of the regional folks. Then I had the opportunity to speak to my service officer again, and we started fighting through this thing for the second time. Well, they decided in their infinite wisdom that they would drop that case. And I'm back to another letter says 100% permanent total until the next time. Well, I got to tell you, you know, if you're not an officer and you don't come home with a Bronze Star or something else, you're a little E1 to E4 coming up the ranks, it is going to be so incredibly hard if you do not have a service officer. I also chair Clackamas County's Veterans Advisory and several other groups. And one of the main things we tell them, the first stop before you go anywhere else is see a veteran service officer. That's where all of the benefits that you may have earned would come from. There's a lot of little groups out here, and you're going to see a lot of little 501Cs. You know, we have horses for vets. We have lap blankets. We got every well-intentioned group in the world. But the issue is, if you divert these young men and women, or the Vietnam vets who have waited 40 or 50 years from starting a service claim, you've just delayed. That is point A. That's where it starts. And like the representative Parrish had said here just a couple of seconds ago, I've been all around the state here in the last year recruiting. I've been to every major fair, events, sporting events, every show you can imagine. We've been there and talked to folks all around the state. I've even been to Burns. And I spent a week in Burns, and you're going to see that the vets out there, supposedly there's no homeless vets, but they have a service officer. And the young men and women out there are still having some of the same issues, and that's the rural health care part of this. But the object is, these are real dollars coming back into your communities. These are the naval and these families. You know, the suicide level is incredibly high. Our generation of vets is surpassing the Vietnam generation, which is absolutely unacceptable. The homelessness, just in Clackamas County alone, and these vets coming home, their children are homeless, of course, because they're with mom and dad. That's where the homeless vets bags. We're trying everything we can, but the truth is, this is going to free up monies for the VFW and for the other service groups, organizations to help these young men and women coming home. Not always can you work with your county service officer. And down at Spirit Mountain, when the tribe was down there, they spoke. And they flat out culturally had issues with the VA. They had issues with how they are processed and how they're handled. And that is where this, again, is going to help the tribal, where they can speak the same customs and the same culture when they've served, to come back in. So what I would leave you with is, this is real dollars. These are real families. When these young men and women coming home, the husband or the wife and the kids are facing the other brunt side of this. And a lot of them are having to leave their jobs or can't go because they've exhausted. You know, my wife exhausted all the federal aid, all the time she could take, all of her sick time, all of her vacation time to help me through the surgeries, and they still continue. So without the service officer helping us with these claims, I just don't see how these young men and women can make it coming home. And the other component of this that you might want to look into in the future is, if you do rate 30% or above, which is your magic number, in the VA, you got to go back and you got to tell these military branches, all five of them, how come these young men and women were not medically retired correctly? Because that's another travesty nationwide there. That's another issue. Thank you. And thank you very much for your service, sir.
Sir.
Chairman Lively, Representative Parrish, and other members, thank you for having us here. My name is Jason Carroll. I'm a past state commander of the Veterans of Foreign Wars. I currently serve as the chairman of our Veterans Service Committee for the state and serve on the National Veterans Service Committee. I support this bill. Not only do I support it, but I can tell you that the Veterans of Foreign Wars supports it strongly. At our state convention, we passed a resolution supported by all the delegates present, representing the 80 posts around the state and our 15,000 members in support of this this bill. It wasn't this particular bill, but it was the same. It had a different number on it, but it was the same issue. The veteran service officers are absolutely essential for the processing of these claims with the VA. The VA bureaucracy is just too much for most individuals to take on themselves. The county service office system is absolutely vital. Now, you say, well, why do veteran services, why does the VFW have to have a service officer? And these are the nonprofits that Julie referred to, the veteran service organizations, the VFW, American Legion, DAV. Many veterans prefer to go to a non-government service officer. They have some distrust for the government. Our service office, which operates out of the VA Regional Center, is only manned by two people, and sometimes only one person because of staffing issues. When we manned that office at 2.5 people, which is what our goal is, the 1 year we really had qualified people in there, it cost us about $110,000 to run that office. There were $55 million in earned benefits brought back to veterans in this state from that investment. On a normal year, when we just have one person or 1.5 people in that service office, we'll bring back $35 million in earned benefits every year to veterans in this state. That's not just members of the VFW. We service any veterans. So that's the magnitude of that. We struggle to fund that service office. We do get some minor funding from the state through ODVA. Our funding from our national organization has been cut. And frankly, if we don't find some additional funding, we will end up closing that service office, and that $35 million will just go elsewhere. The workload is only limited by the capability of our personnel there. If we had more people, we would have more business because the demand is there. The demand is there, I think, in all the service offices around the state. They're all busy. So it's essential that we have adequate funding for these service officers to take care of the veterans. And as Julie's mentioned, and I mentioned again, it's an investment. There's no place you can make that kind of investment and get that kind of return. So with that, I thank you.
Thank you very much.
Chairman Lively and committee members, thank you for the opportunity to come and actually speak to you. And Representative Parrish, thank you always for being a good voice for veterans. I'm Judith Berger out of Deschutes County. I'm a U.S. Army veteran. I was medically discharged 19 years ago. And so my military career was cut very, very short. I fought that end and was not successful, but I was only an E4. That is basically nothing in the military for those of you. No, I mean, bottom, you know, almost at the very bottom. When I got out, they gave me 10% disability for a neurological condition that I found out had I not been 21 years old, had I had a bit more education, had I had some support systems, would have been at minimum 50 or 60%, and it would have been a retirement. Instead, I came back to Oregon. I tried multiple times to be employed, where I lost my job over and over again because of my medical condition. But I didn't know for 5 years that I was even eligible for health care through the VA. So 5 years, no health care. At that time, I met someone who said, well, I'm a county veteran service officer. I might be able to help you a little bit with that. So I went into their office, I spoke with them, and they took me into the VA and got me signed up, so I started having medical care. But they didn't, because of time constraints, because of the amount of people that they were already trying to assist, didn't ask me a lot of fundamental questions about my disability. All they did was found out that I was medically discharged and said, oh, you should have health care. So 12 years later, another veteran service officer ran into me at another event. You know, you walk up to a table that has other veterans and you try to connect. And finally, I was taken under the wing and I now receive 100% disability benefits. But during that time period, it was a tremendous struggle for my family because I was on and off employed, down medically, hospitalized, the list goes on and on. And this bill is so important to making sure that there is money and information available for veterans. And Representative Parrish talked about Vietnam veterans, and that is a population that definitely is resistant to coming into VA or other government-related stuff, and that needs to be available. But I will also say that women veterans are also resistant and hesitant to try to enter into systems that have been very, very difficult for us. So having money available, having resources so that we can have more veteran service officers, be that through veteran service organizations like the VFW, the DAV, the American Legion, or through our county veteran service offices, so that when we call to make an appointment, I meet with veterans all the time, and I tell them, I urge them to call their veteran service officer so they can find out what benefits are available to get the help, the assistance that they have already earned. The waits are incredible. They're 30, 60, 90 days, and then you meet with your veteran service officer, and it takes however long it takes the federal VA system to get it going. But if you're already waiting 30 days, 60, 90, that's three more months that you're having to figure out how you're going to make sure your kids get lunch, how you're going to feed your family, how you're going to have enough fuel to get to work, or whatever it is. So I am in support of this bill, and there are a plethora of reasons. Thank you.
Thank you very much. What's in the boom?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question for you. And I already forgot your name. I'm sorry.
Judith.
Jason and okay. But has anybody done anything about maybe making a matrix you could use online that you could say, you know, like put in your name and then put in all these and then maybe go here and that if you have an injury and they say what it is, then you would apply for this and for the injury part or the medical part or other, just here are all the benefits, and if you've done this and this and this, you get these. And then you'd have an idea of what you're entitled to, and then you could take that kind of pre-application work in.
Frankly, it's a lot more complicated than that. But yeah, the VA does have, I mean, they have a benefits booklet out, which, you know, it's so thick, but it's pretty clear on what it tells, but it's very general. The VA benefits program, what qualifies and what doesn't qualify, and of course the medical decisions that come into that are complicated beyond even the novice or even the experienced level. I mean, I've been dealing with this for years, and I don't even feel qualified to talk to somebody about a claim, and I'm not qualified. The service officers, and that's one thing that we don't realize, service officers are highly trained and talented individuals, and they have to be dedicated and have to have a personality for it, because it's not only do they have to understand all these thousands of pages of VA rules and regulations, and it's not just the VA, but whatever they may have from state benefits, service officers take care of too. So, and it's not just medical; it's their educational benefits and their so it's a lot of things involved in it. So they're highly trained. And then it's very emotionally draining on them. It's hard to be a service officer for a long period of time if you're really dedicated to it. Like our VFW service officer, we pay them so little, they have to be dedicated, and they have to have another source of income because we can't pay them enough.
To put a personal, I guess, answer to that would be, when you are the veteran looking for the resources, a lot of times we're veterans, so we're already supposed to be better than the best, right? And there's all of this kind of stigma that goes with it, whether it's from out, it's usually more internal, like it, you have failed already, so you're not, you know, you're no longer with your team, you're no longer able to serve, so you're already battling that. And then you come into a system where there are all these rules, and what do I really qualify or don't I qualify for? And then you add PTSD, traumatic brain injury, all of these other things that make it more confusing. And it becomes a very emotional thing where if you have a human being who can talk to you and say, well, who know the right questions to ask, because while there are those, they have the e-benefits program from the federal VA, and you know there's another one that just got started. I don't know. I got an email on it yesterday. It's still very confusing on, oh, well, how do you measure those qualifications? And so it's better to have somebody who can ask you the pointed questions to direct you in the right way and can then present the argument articulately, because when it's very personal, it's a lot more difficult.
No, and I understand that. I was my point was is that maybe you could save a little time, and when you go in, you already fill out the form, so to speak.
Well, and that's
I get what you're saying.
Every one of our posts throughout the state has a service officer. We call them a service officer. They aren't a certified service officer. All they are is the first point of entry for that veteran to give them to help them fill out the form. Okay. Then that's passed off to a qualified service officer, a certified service officer.
Representative Escobar, excuse me.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But this comes back to the problems we have within the system. And now let me explain that. When I was put in for my disability by the VA, 18 months later, I received a check for that disability, 18 months. And then about a week after that, I received this great letter from the Tiger team explaining what great work they did to expedite it. Now, to me, that system's broke when you have that. I also might add, I went in because I'm a diabetic from Agent Orange, and I went in and said, you know, at least, why don't, you know, I'm not in the system. At least, I used to be, but I wasn't then. And I said, at least give me my medication. Mm-hmm. And that's pretty fair, you know. Think about it. Well, we can't do that. Why not? Well, you have to be in the system, quote, the system. And I said, well, why? I said, I'll send you all my information from my doctor. You can review it. Then give me my medication. They said, no, you have to be part of the system. You have to see a doctor. And I thought that was rather ironic, because I was in the system for a year and a half and never laid eyes on a doctor. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the system itself is not up to snuff. That's what we need to work on, is the system. Mm-hmm. Or to do away with the system.
Thank you.
And go to local.
Thank you.
That's the way.
That's the answer.
Yeah. And thanks for your service.
Representative Evans.
I don't have a question. I just want to say, one, I apologize for having to come in and out. I was testifying on a bill that's trying to explain how veterans are impacted by some of the predatory credit practices, which affect a lot of our folks coming back. So I really appreciate you all coming. As a life member of VFW myself, I'm always glad to see VFW members in the crowd. The thing that I want to emphasize is, whether it's this bill or others, it is time, this legislative session, it is time to start addressing these problems, and that requires money. And my question is more of a request. Continue coming here until we actually get something done for you. We need you here. Thank you.
Just a quick comment. You know, this bill is not just about VSOs, and as I'm looking at HJR 22 as it was drafted, they actually left out language from 29 and did not put it in 22. So if we do choose to move this bill to rules, it's going to need an amendment, and I will bring that forward to clarify. The VSO piece is actually missing from HJR 22, and it's not supposed to be. But the other piece is while this is not just about veteran service officers, it is about creating those gaps. It's funding that we can have nonprofits and state programs that are providing gap services for things like health care, for things like housing, for, you know, even if we wanted to have babysitting so somebody could get to the VA while they have to leave and drive 4 hours, but they might have a child and they can't leave their child behind to, you know, go from Bend to Portland. What are they supposed to do with their kid? Like, those are the types of things that, as creative as this committee can be, once we have some funding to solve those problems, but it all starts with money, and it all starts with having a dedicated pool. So I just want to say that it's not just about VSOs, it's about all of the different things we can try or pilot and have best practices. I would like Oregon to be a welcome home state, and that doesn't just mean all the policy and Congress memorials and things that we do, but actually putting our money where our mouth is and saying, if you are leaving the service or if you have served and want to come to Oregon, we want to welcome you and have you be here. And again, if that means we're just simply by saying Ken's worth, you know, $3,000 a year and Jason's worth a few bucks a year, if we have to make it about,
Jason,
you know,
ain't worth nothing a year.
You're with priceless is what, for all the work you've done to help with this. But I mean, that if we have to take that tact and say, what do these people actually represent, to get our peers to understand that there's an economic opportunity here as well as the human side. And the last piece I'll just say is Washington State has made a very specific effort to move people and align them out of their state programs and into the VA, you know, and providing for them while they're waiting in that transition, it has saved their state general fund millions of dollars annually. And California is beating us on this, and they are actively investing as a state, and in just a very short period brought home $3.65 billion to the state of California, making this type of investment, even though it might not be lottery, but making that type of investment into their state and their veterans.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. We have about 30 minutes left, and I have five more public hearings scheduled, and so I want people, but there's people here to speak on other bills, too. So we have two more people that have signed up to speak, and so I just ask you to be as brief as you can and make your point so we have an opportunity for other people here to testify on their measure. So I have George Carroll and Chris Mann.
Chairman Levy and other distinguished members. My name is George Carroll. I served 4 years in the Marine Corps, Vietnam. I'm one of those reluctant enlisted men that I don't necessarily trust government, and I have yet to step up and go see a VSO. There's a lot of us out there that are like that. We just have this mistrust that we're even going to be listened to, let alone treated well. I have one comrade who will call me every few months and talk to me in an effort to avoid calling the suicide prevention line because he doesn't want to get put on a list. It's just one of those little quirks that we, as servicemen, are troubled with. You know, we can't always articulate well, and we don't necessarily feel able to talk to people like yourselves or a VSO and get proper care. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Lively and committee members, thank you for having me here today. My name is Chris Mann. I'm actively a staff sergeant currently in the Oregon National Guard. I am the executive director for the Oregon Military Support Network, and next month I graduate with my degree in social behavioral studies. I served in the active Army in the 80s, and I got out for 15 years. After 9/11, I was read articles about these young kids with three deployments, and I said, you know, if I can be a leader, I can be a mentor, and I can be their voice. And I'm happy to say that every day I find somebody to talk to help. Every weekend I check in on my soldiers at the Guard, but every day I'm out there in the community. And one of the stories in Iraq was we were there for 3 months. One of my senior NCOs in E7, somebody who's a leader, motivated, positive, energetic, I looked up to his leadership style. And I saw him eating by himself in the dining facility, and I walked over to him and sat down and started talking, and he was a shell. Talked to the chaplain, got him some care, got him home. I practiced this so many times. 2 months later, he was the gentleman who was chased by the police from the mall. He had an episode, and his anger was out of control, and they had to chase him down and put him in jail. And part of that problem was he hadn't taken care of his PTSD. And our soldiers today, they don't want to go to the VA. They don't want to get flagged in their records, afraid it'll stop their promotions and their careers. And so they don't know where to go. I refer them to people like the Returning Veterans Project, different things like this so they can be seen without letting the Army know, or the Navy, or the Marines, or any of these services know that they've got some things they're dealing with. I ran into this gentleman one day watching some sports games who was a Marine who got blown up in an IED accident, had his face reconstructed. He was 19 years old. His teeth were blown out. While they were discharging him from the military, he missed some appointments and hadn't had his teeth fixed yet. The state of Oregon, the state of California, kept saying, well, you missed your time hack. And I said, that's not true. That can't happen. So luckily, I did go to the VA. It's a good story. And got a hold of one of their people up there. And they contacted him directly. He was going to get his teeth fixed here in the state of Oregon. But every day I run into another soldier who has an incident where they can't get their VA benefits. Gentleman contacted me on Facebook yesterday, said they denied his back claim when he's had three back surgeries while in the service as a Marine. So I'm connecting him with the VSO right now as well. But these stories come every day, but the worst things are the homelessness and the suicides, and they all come back to mental health. We need the funding to have more mental health out there. We need to hire good people to sit in a facility where a veteran can go and talk to somebody and get the mental health. If we don't get the mental health taken care of and the PTSD, it leads to self-medicating, and it leads to the drugs and the alcohol and the rage and living on the streets, and they become one of the 22 people a month that commit suicide. This is the reason why this bill is important, and I thank you for letting me speak here today. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Escalante, did you have a
Thank you, comment? Mr. Chair. Mr. Carroll, I understand exactly what you're saying, because we weren't supported in the field, we weren't supported by our government, we weren't supported by our country, and more importantly, we weren't treated real well when we came home. But trust me, it's time that you went to see a veteran service officer and find out how this country should, would, and could take care of you.
Thank you.
You deserve.
Well, there's a lot of us out there. Thank you.
Thank you. Anything further from the committee? Okay. Thank you both very much for coming and thank testifying. You. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Joint Resolution 22. Do we have the sign up list so I can just see where? Do we have any word of Representative Witt was coming to testify on this bill? I'm just checking to see who else and what bills so we can try to accommodate. Okay, very good. So I'm opening a public hearing on House Bill 2897. Representative Evans.
Thank you, Chair Lively, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Paul Evans, House District 20, which includes Independence, Monmouth, West Salem, and parts of South Salem. Folks up here today, Mr. Dewey and Ms. Martinez, are from financial institutions. Mm-hmm. The bill that is before you, I'll try to make it relatively brief. The goal of the bill, House Bill 2897, which also should have some testimony from Pam Levitt.
Yeah,
from the credit
it's in the record.
As well, is an attempt to try to do something that we don't have the money enough to do ourselves, but together we can, or at least we hope we can. Right now across the country, veterans and veterans' families are struggling with any number of things. This bill is not a solution for all of those. What this bill does do, however, is create a refinance option for veterans in the state of Oregon. Right now, ODVA could do refinancing, but has not been supported in terms of the monies that Congress made available for the ORVET program. There's just not enough money to be able to do that. And while there are some companies out there that can make refinancing loans available at perhaps a lower credit than what this program could do, the singular difference between this program and all the ones that are currently out there is that this would hold the note. So let me say it again. This would hold the note. The one qualifier, one requirement, out of this project will be that ODVA will still be able to do in its refinance what it currently does with its ORVET program. If vets are having a struggle or having an issue 1 month, they can actually work with the person buying the house to be able to keep them in their home. This program probably will not ever become a major program, but it would be an option for those that have bad credit due to multiple deployments, due to other types of things that make them ineligible for reasonable priced refinance loans. And it tries to basically help the private sector be part of the solution by allowing credit unions, and with an amendment we're going to bring in, allow banks the opportunity to lend through ODVA So basically the idea would be not a guaranteed profit, but a guaranteed profit that is at the rate that ODVA can still have funds going in to do some of the programs and projects they need to do for oversight, but at a low enough rate that it is relatively competitive. But again, competitive or not, the value for the veteran and family is they know they have security without their note being sold underneath them. And that's a huge deal in the current climate where we have folks deployed 2 and 3 times and trying to go through reintegration. So I'm going to stop there and say this bill basically gives ODVA the authority to start setting something like this up. It doesn't, I don't believe, it requires additional legal authority. Rather, it simply creates the ability for a public-private partnership utilizing credit unions and, again, with an amendment that we will have certain financial institutions.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, Pam Levitt would normally be here. She's engaged otherwise. I'm here on behalf of the Northwest Credit Union Association, and you have Pam's testimony on behalf of the association. Pam and others have been working with the good representative from the Salem area on what we think is a very valuable approach, another approach which is good, a private-public partnership. Now, this isn't the easiest thing to do, but it starts the discussion and the parameters by which we would be able to do it, and the people that are smarter than me would be sitting down and figuring out how to do it. Another tool in the toolbox, if you will, for veterans, particularly those that are being deployed, a place they can go where hopefully quickly they can look at offers and opportunities from the financial institutions. So I will stop there. Thank you
very much.
Mr. Chair, Madam Vice Chair, members of the committee, Tim Martinez here on behalf of the Oregon Bankers Association and the Oregon Independent Community Banks of Oregon. I'm a little disappointed. I certainly enjoy my good friend, Mr. Dewey, but I wish Pam was sitting there so she could hear me say me too. We very rarely say me too at the same time. So I'd also be remiss if I didn't thank the sponsor, Representative Evans, for having an amendment drafted to include banks. He and I have had a conversation regarding why they weren't included to begin with, but I do appreciate him bringing them in. It's I think it's unclear at this point how many will actually use this, but it is another tool and a very valuable one, and one we're anxious to get implemented so we can see how it might work to help veterans. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Questions for this panel? Thank you all for being here. Thank you, Paul, for introducing this legislation. You're working on an amendment, I take it?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
It should be back next week.
Okay. Close the public hearing on 2897. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3116. Mr. Administrator, would you let us know what this one does?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, House Bill 3116 establishes a task force to study how to provide benefits for disabled veterans through the Preferred Worker Program. Requires the task force to submit recommendations to the Legislative Assembly by September 15, 2016. Declares an emergency effective on passage. There is a subsequent referral to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means.
Very good. I have Mr. John Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Vice Chairs, members of the committee, I'm John Schultz. I'm the administrator of the Oregon Workers' Compensation Division, part of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. The Preferred Worker Program is a program that's part of our workers' compensation system here in Oregon. And under workers' compensation law, this program was created by the legislature some years back to help injured workers who were unable to return to their pre-injury jobs because of permanent disability. The program provides assistance to those workers as well as the employers who hire them. The law defines a preferred worker as a worker who's unable to return to their regular employment because of their permanent disability resulting from their workplace injury or occupational disease. The assistance that's available under this program includes no workers' compensation premiums to be charged to the employer for 3 years after hire under this program, claim cost reimbursement if the worker is re-injured during that 3-year period, wage subsidy of 50% of the workers' wages for up to 6 months, employment purchases such as uniforms, tools, tuition that the worker might need to be successful in the job, and then worksite modification to overcome any injury cause limitations so the worker can do the job. And normally that's capped at $25,000, but we also have a exceptional disability category, so it's really there's no cap where there's an exceptional disability, and that's defined in the administrative rules. This program, as I mentioned, is administered as part of our program at the Workers' Compensation Division. It's funded through the Workers' Benefit Fund. The Workers' Benefit Fund is funded equally by subject Oregon employers and workers via payroll reductions, and the revenue is provided actually to Department of Revenue on the quarterly payroll assessment, and they send our part of that revenue to the workers' DCBS. In 2014, the department, to give you an idea about the type of dollars that are expended, in 2014, the department expended about $7 million on this program, providing incentives and benefits to workers to return to work. House Bill 3116, getting to the bill now, establishes a task force to evaluate including disabled veterans in the preferred worker program. HB 3116 would establish a task force to evaluate, including those disabled veterans, in the preferred worker program. And the bill requires DCBS to staff the task force and reimburse expenses of task force members appropriated from the department for task force purposes. There are no funds that are appropriated under the bill as written. Given the large number of bills assigning work to DCBS this session, we may need to establish some funding to support the task force efforts. The way the bill is currently written, it directs the task force to focus on ways to allow disabled veterans to use DCBS's preferred worker program. We take that as a compliment, but there may be some challenges to that approach. As I mentioned, the workers' compensation law has specific definition on how injured workers will qualify for the preferred worker program. The disability of a veteran is established in a completely separate process outside the Oregon workers' compensation system. Also, most veterans and their federal employers do not pay into the workers' benefit fund. We understand from the bill's proponent, Representative Witt, that his intent is to establish a program for veterans modeled after this program and to make the program operate from funds available to the Oregon Veterans Department. Oh, hi. An amendment would help clarify that intent to the extent that we can help with any amendment or the development of this program. We would be very happy to do so. We do think this is a good program, and we see the intent as something that would be very good. The only other suggestion we had on this bill is a very small one. There's a reference to the preferred worker program in Section 1, referencing ORS 656340. We think the reference actually should be ORS 656622, which is the specific reference in the law to the preferred worker program. And I'd be happy to be quiet now or answer any questions or wait until after Representative Witt addresses.
Representative Witt, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good afternoon to yourself and committee members, State Representative Brad Witt from Oregon's House District 31, appearing today on behalf of House Bill 3116. This is a bill that asks for a task force to take a look at creating a preferred worker program for veterans who have experienced permanent disability. I want to emphasize that in its current form, the bill is less than perfect. The intent of the bill was to use the preferred worker program in workers' compensation as a model for creating a similar program for disabled veterans, as opposed to rolling disabled veterans into the workers' compensation system. I would tell you that if the proposal were to stand as written, I would have to oppose my own bill. I spent a decade and a half trying to fight for workers' compensation to maintain the integrity of that system. And I will tell you that there are two groups that system was created to protect, employers and workers. It was not created for injured veterans, but we would be well served, I think, to have a program that would indemnify employers from prospective employees who perhaps would have the potential for a greater chance at injury or re-injuring in their employment. And I also think that the workers' compensation model suggests that worksite modification makes it possible for the employee to perform his or her job better and enables the employer to hire that worker when otherwise it might not be possible. Lastly, the workers' compensation system as a model provides that tools, equipment, and clothing for that individual is made available. I think that that again gets past some barriers, enables that person to get into the workforce. And finally, while I think it's ideal, I'm not sure that the system can afford it. The task force should look at it. But that is the concept of a wage subsidy. And I think that may be something that we have to wait on. But other components of the preferred worker compensation system or preferred worker program, rather, in workers' compensation provides an extremely good model of how we may be able to get some veterans who otherwise would be on the outside looking in back into the workforce. I want to emphasize, Mr. Chairman, that this bill was not my idea. It was the concept was brought forward by Mark Davison, who is a very, very long-time a practitioner in workers' compensation, as well as loss control. He served, I think, three decades in that role, and did so for a large part of the time for Safeway Corporation. Those of you who know my background know that he was my counterpart on the opposite side of the table in labor relations, as I have served as a union representative and negotiator in the food industry for workers. Mr. Davison is a Vietnam veteran. In his service, I would point out, was not done behind a desk. He was on the front lines. He feels very strongly about this and unfortunately was unable to be here today. He's quite ill. And I have been honored that he asked me to bring this bill forward and would ask that the committee consider.
Thank you.
Honoring him with this bill.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Any questions? Representative Escobar.
Yes, I have just one question, and it's to either and or. Great bill. What is the determination, though, for degree of disabled veteran? Because that goes from 10% to 100%. I think that's a fair question.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Esquivel, again, I think that is something that the task force would need to cover, and I think we both know someone who has a partial disability from Vietnam as well. So,
anything?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Thanks a lot, Representative Witt, for bringing that forward and for your testimony.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
You bet.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you.
Close the public hearing on House Bill 3116, and we have two more
But I'm going to move to House Bill 3393 because we have another person here who wants to provide some testimony. So I'm going to open the hearing on House Bill 3393. And Mr. Minister, could you summarize the bill for us?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, House Bill 3393 establishes a task force on public safety coordination, requires task force report to legislative assembly by 15 September 2016, sunsets 31 December 2016, declares an emergency effective on passage, and has a subsequent referral to the House Committee on Judiciary.
Okay. And Eric, would you like to come up now?
Did we just see him?
Yes.
I thought so.
Chair Lively, Vice Chair Stovall, sadly, yes. You have just seen me, and I will try to make mine brief as well on this one. Members of the committee, again, for the record, my name is Paul Evans. I represent House District 20, Independence, Monmouth, West Salem, South Salem. And this is the last of the bills today that I'm bringing forward.
I'm glad you put that qualifier in.
Yes, sir. Thank you. This bill is... The goal of this bill is to bring about a conversation about how we start thinking about public safety delivery in an age of limits. And here's what I mean by that. For some time, we have been struggling very hard to try to maintain services that are needed and necessary through structures and systems that were built with a very different tax system than we have right now. We have counties, Polk County, where I live, being one of them, that is in a last-ditch effort going to be going before the voters for yet another public safety levy. It may pass, it may not pass. Even if it does pass, it will not pass at the rate that keeps the jail staffed at a level that is premium for safety, and it will still have very constrained resources for patrols and other types of duties. We have state police that in many cases, one example comes to mind, in Southern Oregon, one of the retired superintendents was telling me the other day that when he was first on as a road fella, it was 27 people or so down in Medford, and now I think there's four or five that are permanently stationed in Medford, I think. Just the scale of what we cannot do has shifted to the point that I think it's time we rethink how we deliver it. And this task force is designed to bring everybody together and look at other models that are going around the country and see if we're delivering services as a state and potentially in certain areas where counties can no longer provide certain services, if there are ways we can do things a little smarter, a little better. That's the intent of the task force, just to bring people together, have that conversation. Yes, I know. Another task force, working group that I would like to volunteer represent Huffman for if it passes.
Thank you for that.
That's basically the bill. So I'll stop there and try to answer your questions.
Thank you, Representative Evans. Introduce yourself for the record, please.
Thank you, Chair Lively, members of the committee. My name is Eric Skablis. I'm the director of the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training, more often known as DPSST. Our agency is neutral on the bill, but since the bill does ask us to coordinate the task force, we thought it would be important to share some feedback with you. The public safety family from the state affected by this work group would be State Police, Emergency Management, the Military Department, Office of State Fire Marshal, and DPSST. There are some other state public safety partners that we work with, and that's Department of Corrections, the Criminal Justice Commission, the Youth Authority, the Parole Board, and the Department of Justice Criminal Justice Division. So that list, if you will, is a state public safety family. We work together every day. The best way to think about this, the state public safety family, is a highway with lanes. And each of our agencies have lanes that we are given by legislative action and by budget authority. So we work together daily to meet the mission that you and the people of Oregon ask us to do. Our agencies all get along very well. So there is no disagreement about who does what. And to give you some example, we're working collectively right now on the School Safety and Preparedness Task Force that was approved by this body. We're working on the Cascadia Earthquake Preparedness collectively. We just met a few weeks ago talking about ESF 14, which is how law enforcement will respond. We're working together with Emergency Management on that. They're the lead. I know Representative Huffman and I have had discussions on this. We're working collectively with ODOT on traffic incident management, on how do we open up freeways faster. And it's not just an ODOT issue. It's not just a law enforcement issue. It's also a fire rescue issue. So all those different players are together, and we're moving forward on that. We work together on wildfires. How do we evacuate communities? How do all of our agencies pull up resources quickly to get there to help? And it's not who's in charge. It's who needs to do what. And we do that on a daily basis. We also work on communications. I know you heard about FirstNet and some of those things. We're all partners in that discussion. And then finally, one of the discussions, obviously, actually happening in this building across the country, is we're working on race-based profiling. Obviously, it doesn't affect emergency management, but it does affect state police and DPSST. We're partners with a group that some of you know is called LECC, Law Enforcement Context Committee. The one thing I'll add, and I know you spoke a lot about veterans, but we also lean in on veterans' issues collectively from public safety, and that includes working with the VSOs, as well as working with mental health issues. So all of us are working on helping veterans get the help that they need so that they're not in the criminal justice system, but they're getting help through other vehicles that are there. So we're working on that collectively, and I thought it would be important to share that based on the earlier discussions. We collectively have partnerships statewide. City, county, state, every agency and every tribe is affected by what we do. We also have dozens of individual partnerships with our federal partners, whether it's the FBI, the Secret Service, ATF, you name it, whoever has the liaison, they're the ones taking the lead on that. This bill, as Representative Evans said, would be the not do we get along, because we do, this would be the looking at becoming one. We've submitted a fiscal impact, not because it's a bad idea, because we honestly don't have the staff to do this straight up. This is a complex wiring diagram, not only from a budget standpoint, but from a legislative standpoint, from a partnership standpoint. So if you're interested in moving forward, we're glad to coordinate it, but we just can't do it with the resources we have today. So we'd be glad to answer any questions you may have, and appreciate your time.
Thank you, Representative Evans.
Chair Lavely, if I could follow up.
Yeah.
That's actually, he listed why I wanted DPSST at the heart of it. He made the case. I wouldn't be asking for out of Hyde, because if we did it out of Hyde, it wouldn't probably get us the quality that we need. And again, everything that he listed is because of the mission of DPSST as a training element. They are a critical nexus. My concern is more of a strategic at the 30 to 50,000 foot look of which where I think the legislature should play at, not in the tactical delivery, but how are we going to continue to provide the same level of service or the level of services that our citizens need if our tax rate and the way we funded things isn't going to get any better? And that's my concern, that I don't want us to find a situation where we're asking the agencies to continue to rob Peter to pay Paul, although as Paul I would appreciate that, but nonetheless, robbing Peter to pay Paul to do things. How can we help think two, three steps ahead to make sure that we're making investments and making giving them the tools they're going to need as things evolve in a world that I don't think is going to have a whole lot more revenue?
Representative Escobar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Myself and Andy Olson have 10 years now, 10 times. Or five times for sure, have put in a bill to attach the state police to dedicated funding through Oregon Liquor Control Commission before it dumps into the general fund, which once it dumps into the black hole, it goes wherever. Now, what we wanted was in 1976, we had almost 700 state police officers. The population then was substantially less than it is today, and today we have less than 400. But we're trying to cover more area. And what I mean by that, I don't know if Polk County's an ONC county. Hmm. Okay, so you're going through the same thing, Josephine.
Yes, sir.
Curry County. We did get up to, I think, 14 officers again in Jackson County, but they took six and took them to Josephine County because they had lost their sheriff's department. So consequently, we don't have 24/7 again, and we haven't for a number of years. But as long as we let this linger, and as long as we don't approach this problem, someday we're going to have to pay the piper. And when we do, Katie, bar the door, because it's not going to be fun.
Thank you. Any Representative Boone?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Esquivel just made this old brain remember something.
Uh-oh.
Look out. Yeah, we tried again to a $1 fee on car registrations, and it would have raised a gazillion dollars and funding.
A gazillion. A lot of money.
A gazillion, whatever you want to call it. would have paid for a big chunk of state police, and it could be a permanent for, but we could not get a fee bill through, and that's been the problem. Just $1, and who even misses a dollar anymore, really, in all reality?
Careful.
Well.
Any,
is it bad to
no,
say?
Oh. It's not. any further questions or comments?
Thank you for the opportunity
Thank
to bring
you,
this forward.
Representative Evans. Thanks Thank you. For coming. Thanks. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3393. I'm going to announce that I'm going to carry over the public hearing on House Bill 3354 to Tuesday, March 31st.
Any more business to come before the committee?
Good job, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
You made it before. Good job, Mr. Chair.